KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Tens of millions of Japanese read manga each day. We find out in the hour ahead all about manga and why it's so popular and beloved in Japan, a multi-billion dollar industry that is now global in scope but has strong national cultural heritage in Japan. And what is manga, you ask? Comics. All about manga with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Manga is the Japanese word for comics, literally meaning whimsical pictures. Over 2 billion are produced each year in what has become a multi-billion dollar industry. And in Japan, where there are hundreds of magazines and anthologies, graphic novels and animated films, manga is supreme. 40% of all published media in Japan is manga, compared to only 4% here in the United States. And a manga exhibit, the first one staged outside of Japan, is presently at San Francisco's Asian Art Museum. It focuses on the man known as the god of manga, Tezuka Osamu, and it will be at the museum until the 9th of September. In this hour of Forum, we want to explore the world of manga, and joining us here in studio is Fred Schad, an author, translator, and Tezuka Osamu historian. His works include Manga Manga, the world of, it's like Tora Tora, the world of Japanese comics, and the Astro Boy essays, and we welcome you, Fred Schad.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here, and also glad to have Carl Horn, who's joining us from up in Portland, Oregon, and he's manga editor for Dark Horse Comics. Welcome, Carl Horn.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Good morning, and thank you. Let me begin, Carl Schad, with you. I was surprised to learn, with all the Japanese emphasis and all the Japanese identification with manga, that not only does it have a strong influence from Disney and from growing up with Jiggs and Maggie, growing up with father, American comics, but it has its roots in some ways in Genesis here in San Francisco.
Actually, you can make the argument that the first American comic book, or at least the graphic novel, was produced here in San Francisco on Sutter Street. There was an immigrant from Japan who came here at the beginning of the 20th century. And in 1927, he exhibited a work that he created, which was semi-autobiographical. It was over 100 pages long. And then he actually published it in 1931. And his name was Henry Kiyama. And it was published here by the name, under the title of the Four Students Manga, or also the Four Immigrants Manga.
And yet, despite all the influence here, manga is, when we identify it not only with Japan, it's monochrome, it's not richly colored like American and European comics. That's one of the basic distinctions, I guess, isn't it?
Right. Generally, Japanese manga or comics are monochrome, but they'll often have, in the beginning of the story, they'll have four-color printing, or they'll have two-color printing, and they'll use red or blue combined with black and white to create a sort of an illusion of color. But the bulk of Japanese manga are monochrome.
Explain to me, though, the influence, because on the one hand, it's lowbrow, it's a disposable commodity, people throw their manga out after they're done with it, you know. It's described often as light entertainment, and in fact, the man that you're an expert on, Tezuka Osamu, said, was quoted in Kenneth Baker's column, saying, if you take out the nonsense from manga, what would be left? And yet this has been a mega force culturally. You describe it as a mega force culturally.
Well, I think that it's true that they're very light entertainment, and actually compared to even American comic books, manga are almost designed to be inhaled. You just roar through these stories. Japanese young people have an amazing ability to just rip through a magazine that's 300 pages long in 30 minutes and then throw it away. So it's highly disposable entertainment when it first appears. But it's then cataloged into paperback books and usually issued as a series if the stories have any kind of popular, if they become popular. There are artists like Tezuka who, while they've valued the ability to include a lot of jokes and nonsensical humor, they've tried to use what is essentially an American medium, comic book medium, to tell very serious stories and elevate the comic book medium to that of what we would think film and also novels are capable of. So Tezuka, for example, was really aiming at something much higher than we think of as comic books. He was aiming at using the comic book format to basically do what Russian authors have done with Russian literature.
Well, he's been compared to Da Vinci, no less.
Well, in Japan, yeah, he's way up there with the luminaries of the 20th century, and it's hard for Americans, I think, to conceive of how revered he is. He's called the god of manga, or manga no kamisama, and there are, of course, many other people who've contributed to the development of comic books and manga in Japan, but
Tezuka really towered
over everyone. Yeah.
And Tezuka is the correct pronunciation. Forgive me, I never heard it pronounced, so I sound like Tezuka or something like that to my ear, because unlike you, I'm not fluent in Japanese. He died, we should mention, in February of 1989, and this exhibit, first major exhibit of its kind, is here at the Asian Art Museum and focuses on his work. And when you focus on his work, you often focus on Astro Boy or the Mighty Atom, this androgynous, cute figure that looks sort of diminutive and looks kind of like, reminds me a little bit of Mighty Mouse, actually.
Right. Astro Boy is, in Japan it's known as Tetsuwa Atomu, but that translates to Mighty Atom, and in America it became Astro Boy, so we know the character as Astro Boy. Astro Boy was first created in 1952 as a manga or comic book, and then later on Tezuka turned it into Japan's first black-and-white TV animation series in 1963, and that was exported to the United States. So you could say that it was the beginning of the, or what we think of as anime in the United States.
Boy, Tezuka, they identify with this character, don't they? I mean, the Japanese,
it's very popular. And, of course, Tezuka created it for a very long time. He was drawing it until around 1967, 68, so that's a period of well over 20 years, 25 years. It just caught the imagination of young children, I think, especially because it appeared at a time in Japan when there was a craving for inexpensive entertainment among young people, because Japan was actually still occupied by the U.S. Army in 1951-52 when Astro Boy was first created, and people were starving. The calorie intake of average Japanese in 1951 was still very, very low. And people had been denied entertainment throughout the war, so there was a real pent-up demand for something that just was optimistic, depicted a future. It was set in the future, and it wasn't focused on what had happened and the destruction that people were so aware of.
Well, it's kind of, even though I think Tezuka's had an MD and a PhD, it was sort of anti-science and technology, or at least anti nuclear weaponry. This was not that long after Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right. The irony is that although the Astro Boy series in the original manga has a very strong anti-technology, anti-science, and pacifist theme, in reality in Japan, because Japan, I think, was rebuilding, the mass media and especially the corporate world in Japan latched onto Astro Boy as this sort of optimistic flag bearer for scientific civilization. And Astro Boy came to be perceived as this symbol of an optimistic future where Japan had advanced technology.
Why is there such greater enthusiasm, love, and consumption of comics in Japan than there is really anywhere on Earth? Do we have an answer to that mystery?
I think to answer that would take a very, very long time, and I've written several books about that. But
the Donald Ritchie of comics.
Well, I'm flattered to be called that. But I think, conversely, Japanese would ask the question, why aren't comic books more popular in the United States? And I think when we as Americans are surprised by the popularity of manga and comic books in Japan, and even animation in Japan, we really need to go back and examine our own history, because actually comic books were far more popular here in the 1940s and 50s than they are today. And the lack of interest in comic books in the United States is partly the result of a censorship campaign that took place in the United States in the 1950s and was maintained by American comic books publishers. And it tended to kind of ghettoize comic books as a medium of entertainment, as something for they became stigmatized as something for children and young adults, and they focused mainly on superheroes because it was a safe genre. If that hadn't happened, if that censorship campaign had not happened in the 50s, and if television had perhaps been introduced a little bit later in the United States, we might have a comic books culture that's very similar to Japan's today.
Some of the comic books in the 50s, I remember, were pretty horrific. I mean, you know, they were over the top as far as scary and violent, and, you know, that was there was a whole campaign, like there have been many campaigns to try to curb that industry, thinking that that industry was somehow undermining and influencing our youth in baleful ways. Fred Schott, by the way, again, is the author of Manga Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, and the Astro Boy Essays. And Carl Horn is manga editor for Dark Horse Comics. I think, Carl, you're the only people that publish original manga in the country here?
Well, when you say original manga, do you mean the Japanese comics?
Yes.
Well, no, actually, there's quite a few people publishing it. We are the second oldest publisher of it in the United States. Right now, we're celebrating our 19th anniversary. The oldest publisher is actually right there in San Francisco, Viz Communications, now known as Viz Media. And they certainly are part of San Francisco having a strong tradition when it comes to this sort of culture and being in the vanguard of really developing it for the English-speaking world.
Well, it's different kind of comic books. I mean, it's cinematic technique. It's decompression of storylines. It's also manga, we ought to add, is really pretty much the underlying source for films in Japan, isn't it?
It's considered to have a strong influence. You know, Dark Horse, for example, there are various movies that have come out recently, such as 300 and Hellboy and Sin City. These are all based on original comics we've done. And one difference between these type of films and, say, Marvel and DC adaptations, films like X-Men or Batman and Superman, is we try to be much closer to the original comic, actually have the comic creator on set, actually base shots on the coloring and the lighting and so forth. In other words, treat the comic as the primary creative work. And that's the type of influence you also see that manga has had in many cases in film in Japan, be it live action or animation. Unlike an ordinary film, which is adopted, say, from a book, a manga is not only giving you your characters and dialogue and narrative, but it's also giving you a lot of its visual information as well. So much so, as a matter of fact, that there is the argument that in such cases, is it really the manga that's the main creative work and the film is simply, you know, a derivative of it?
Well, we should also mention manga rivals television in Japan, and in some demographics actually is more popular than television. And speaking of television, I was looking at one of your publications called Eagle, which brings up The West Wing, one of the most popular television shows of recent history. Here you have a manga artist, a comic book artist, Kaiji Kawaguchi, taking American politics and turning them into manga.
Yes, this is published by Viz between 2000 and 2001, which obviously was a very dramatic time in American politics and history as well. And what you had is this creator, Kawaguchi, who already had become a great bestseller in the manga field. He did a series in the 1990s called The Silent Service that sold over 25 million copies in paperback. And he became known as someone who was doing modern-day stories about geopolitics, you know, exciting adventure stories that, you know, keep you reading, but also stories that tried to be grounded in the real issues of the day from a Japanese perspective. And he was quite interested in the American political process because there's nothing like it in Japan. They have, of course, a parliamentary system of government, and in many ways the U.S. system of government is somewhat unique, and especially our high-powered, you know, methods of politics. So he imagined a fictitious Japanese-American senator from New York State.
It was half Japanese, I believe, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Then aspires to beat various thinly disguised people, such as Al Gore and Hillary Clinton, to the Democratic nomination. And he sort of used this as a vehicle to not only explain to the Japanese the American political process, but also his own ideas about America's place in the world. And it was ultimately a pro-American strip, but he taught me things about my own country that I hadn't realized and pointed out to things, you know, with his outsider's perspective, he noticed things that never really, you know, had hit me before. And I felt I was actually learning something from this manga.
Well, talk about what we learned from comparing or contrasting manga produced in Japan with comic books here. I mean, they're designed differently. The manga is, first of all, designed to reach a much more mass audience. It's cheaper. But what about the content of it? I mean, how is the stamp of Japanese culture is pretty much the most obvious or apparent thing?
I think the development of diverse content and an accessible format have gone hand in hand. We know a lot about the creators of manga, and it's quite certain there would be no manga industry at all without Osamu Tezuka. What we still need to know more is about the business development, about who are the publishers, who are the editors. You know, it wasn't always the case that the average Japanese adult read manga. That happened only gradually. The first manga magazines were for kids. And gradually in the 60s, you started to see older readership coming in, college students and so forth. And by the 70s, you began to see the idea of adults reading comics as seen as more normal. So it was a gradual process. And I think the fact that manga prices were kept low, they were kept accessible. You know, manga are a tremendous bargain compared to American comics. Helped to keep it in the public eye. And there's no shortage of talent when it comes to American and European comics creators. You know, you can find creator for creator, you can find people in the West who would, you know, are the equal of anyone in Japan. But the U.S. comics system isn't currently set up to reach a mass audience. It's set up to reach a audience of specialists and collectors and people who really care to go to their store and to get it every month. But that's not the same thing as reaching out to a mass audience.
There's a lot of crossover, I know, but aren't the mangas also geared toward specifically young females, young males, and adults? Different demographics, yeah.
This ties in a little bit to what Fred Schott was saying earlier about censorship. You know, we all know about the, you were mentioning some of the notorious horror comics, the 1950s, and certainly those made an impression. But the comics code that was adopted in the 1950s didn't just ban things like, you know, decapitations and zombies. You couldn't even really talk about divorce. So you used to have a fairly robust comics produced for girls in the U.S., which would talk about family, relationship issues, things like that, in a fairly realistic fashion. But along with the general moral code that was imposed on comics, it wasn't just the case that the good guy always had to defeat, you know, the villain. It was also the case that families had to be happy, you know, and things always had to be resolved. So comics gradually lost their ability to create stories that ordinary people could relate to. And the code contributed, you know, to a sort of narrative stereotyping of comics in which the acceptable type of stories they could do, not only in terms of violence or nudity or things like that, but even in terms of worldview, you know, gradually narrowed.
And, so, and did Japan have simply not have this kind of code or less of
a Well, code? There are always people, comics are not universally popular in Japan, and there are many people who think that they're, you know, lowbrow trash. There's certainly a PTA in Japan, and there are campaigns against them. Every once in a while, you'll have political and police campaigns against comics in Japan. But comics go on, you know. They don't, they have a certain strength and they developed over the years, and they have a certain muscle, and they have great creators they can point to and the influence. And nobody can simply dismiss, you know, manga in Japan. They can criticize it, you know, they can sort of snipe at it, but it doesn't have that kind of underground, you know, almost ghetto quality it has in the U.S.
So they have all their Godzillas intact, so to speak?
So to speak. People like Osamu Tezuka, you know, have been the giants in the field. What happens, of course, with a Dr. Tezuka is his example, it's not only the work that he created, but what he showed was possible. He had a real fearlessness as a creator. Not necessarily that he was going to, you know, smash the bourgeoisie and all that. You know, he was a great entertainer. But it never seemed to occur to Tezuka that there was anything he couldn't draw a comic about, that he couldn't talk about this kind of subject, that he couldn't talk about human nature as it actually was. So he had a great fearlessness as an artist, not to mention a tremendous talent, you know, on pen and paper. And that really inspired people and is part of what made him a hero to so many.
And that includes a number of Americans. I think Frank Miller's been a lot influenced by him, hasn't he?
I certainly know that Frank Miller's been influenced by Kazuo Koike and Goseki Kojima. They were the creator of probably manga's greatest samurai epic, Lone Wolf and Cub, which is published by Dark Horse. But the shadow of Tezuka pretty much lies over everybody. And I think you can also see the influence of Tezuka specifically in Frank Miller's work, Rusty the Robot and the Big Guy, which is drawn by Jeff Darrow. In some ways, it was kind of a parody of the Astro Boy versus the American notion of a superhero. Rusty is this little cute Japanese robot, very much in the Astro Boy mode, whereas the Americans have their own hero robot, except he's the size of an aircraft carrier. So it's kind of a commentary on the differences between what the Japanese think makes a good hero and what the Americans think makes a good hero.
Well, there are big differences. In fact, Fred Schott, obviously real formidable challenges to you as a translator to bring in some of these things that don't necessarily always translate from Japanese culture to American.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about that, and Carl would probably agree with me, is that actually it's getting easier and easier. There was a period where we were so afraid that American audiences wouldn't be able to understand some of the minutiae of Japanese culture and a lot of the exotic aspects of Japanese culture. But now there's been, I think, a real mind meld that's going on between young Japanese and young Americans in particular, so that young Americans have no resistance to sushi, to things like futon, and they understand.
Pokemon.
Pokemon. Kids in America today are actually raised on a lot of Japanese ideas that are embedded in Pokemon and other anime, so that the translation has actually become a lot easier.
Well, plus now, globalization. Right?
Yeah, that doesn't mean that there's are no challenges whenever there are puns involved, and in particular when there are language puns that are associated with visual puns in comics, that becomes very difficult to translate. But it has become much easier to pitch things to an American audience than it was, say, 25 years ago.
You agree with that, Carl Horn?
Definitely so. You know, when I was growing up and when I was getting into manga in the 1980s, there was still a lot of talk about, you know, remember Pearl Harbor and so forth. And remember, in the 1980s, when manga was first being published here, the geopolitical landscape for U.S. versus Japan was quite different. The way people talk about China today is kind of the way they were talking about Japan 20 years ago. That is to say, as a competitor to the United States, that, you know, when I was growing up, we were taught the Japanese were in risk of taking over U.S. institutions and banks and so forth.
Remember Rising Sun.
Exactly. Now, the odd thing is that back then, the mainstream media would never report about Japanese pop culture. Nowadays, you rarely hear the mainstream media talk about any serious Japanese issues, you know, what's going on with their economy and their central bank and all that. And all the stories are about pop culture. You know, there's been a complete turnaround. So Japan has, you know, projecting now that so-called soft power. And, you know, Pokemon is sort of an example of what I was talking about, that difference between the American and Japanese notion of a hero. The Pokemon are all really cute. They're little small guys, you know, who have powers. And I can't help but think that's a Japanese approach which has charmed, you know, Americans who are used to the idea of the hero being, you know, strong, muscular, and so forth.
Well, no more of this East is East and West is West. We're seeing the twain meeting on all kinds of fronts. And we're talking about manga this hour with Carl Horn, who's manga editor for Dark Horse Comics, and Fred Schott, who's an author, translator, and Tezuka Osamu historian, and the author of Manga Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, and the Astro Boy essays. And as I said, there's an exhibit that is presently at the San Francisco Asian Art Museum, and there are also open phone lines for those of you who would like to join us in conversation here about manga. Do you read manga? Are you interested in it? What do you see as the convergences between, say, Japanese culture and American culture? But also, let's talk about comics and how they differ and what that means that Japan particularly is so given to not only reading comics on all levels and all classes, but that has become such an intrinsic part of Japanese culture. We welcome your calls. Any questions or comments are indeed welcome. You can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786, and we'll work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can also email us, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the growth of manga. It's a form of serialized comics that in Japan actually rivals television in popularity. Joining us this hour, Carl Horn from Dark Horse Comics, and Fred Schott, who's the author of Manga Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, and the Astro Boy essays. And Fred Schott, in addition to being an expert on manga, particularly is an expert on the work of Tezuka Osamu. We were talking about how the name, if it's correctly put in its Japanese order, would be Osamu Tezuka, which is done at the exhibit, the reverse, excuse me, so you can invert that for best use, which is the case at the Asian Art Museum. And I was saying also off air that you can get a little bit confused about the fact that these Japanese comics read from right to left. You start from the back and then you go to the front. Fred, yeah?
Yeah, this is actually a subject that I'm sure both Carl and I could talk about for a couple hours. Japanese comics are normally read from right to left, from the top right of the page all the way down to the bottom left of the page. So when Japanese comics or manga were originally translated into English, they were all flopped or flipped. So a mirror image was created of the page, and then they were written, or the writing was converted into English so that Americans could read the manga just like they would read an American comic book. Young American fans of manga, however, have now become so sophisticated that they actually prefer to read the translated comics from right to left, in other words, Japanese style. From,
like driving in England.
That's
used
right.
To it, and there it is. So.
And it's a very interesting phenomenon because the fans in the United States want to get as close as possible to the original manga. But nonetheless, because the translated manga have to be in English because most of the fans still do not read Japanese, the text within the word balloons is from left to right. So you have a slight discontinuity in what's become popular in the industry today. But there's been a switch in the last few years from flipping all the images and making it completely American style to just leaving the pages in Japanese style and just translating the text. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
It is indeed. It's also evocative of the old joke that took place, I guess, during the Six-Day War, or after the Six-Day War, when Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State and got a telegram supposedly from Golda Meir, then the Prime Minister of Israel, saying, Henry, I want to remind you that you're Jewish first, and he wrote back and said, I'm an American first, I'm Secretary of State second, and third, I'm Jewish. And Golda Meir supposedly wrote back and said, in Israel, we read from right to left. So there you have it. We're going to go to our callers, and we begin, Matt, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm just going to start out, I guess, by not asking a question, so to speak, but raising up a point that manga really is part of this sort of a component, very prominent component of this soup of Japanese pop cultural influences that I guess the term is otaku culture. But I work as a creative director for Joie de Vivre Hospitality here in San Francisco. We just finished designing a hotel in Japantown that's based on Japanese pop culture, and manga fits in very prominently there. But this idea of otaku culture as sort of composed of both anime, manga, Japanese pop music, film, fashion design, was a really rich palette, provided a really rich palette of information for us in designing the hotel.
Well, thank you for that comment. Appreciate that. And we'll go to more of your calls. John, good morning. You're on the air with us. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is another great and interesting show in a lot of ways. I have both a comment and a question. My comment is, as a teacher of computer networking and applications, I'm actually seeing an awful lot of our books being a whole lot more like comic books than they are like textbooks these days for perhaps a number of reasons. But my question for your panel was, do you think that the fact that the Japanese language is a pictographic language could be part of the influence on why manga is so much more of a part of that culture than it is of the United States?
What do you think, Fred Schott?
Well, I think there are many, many reasons that manga have become so popular in Japan, and as I mentioned earlier in the show, it would probably take a long time to go over all of them. The link between ideograms and manga is often pointed out, and there are some similarities in the sense that Japanese characters or the Chinese character element of the Japanese language is or originated as a type of pictograph. But it's not the only reason, because if that were the case, that Japanese use these characters and therefore manga are so popular, we would expect to find that manga are just or even more popular in China, which is not the case. So it's just one element, I think, of a whole slew of reasons that have affected this.
And thank you, John, for bringing that up. Before I go to more of your calls, go to some emails here. Danny writes, the manga Hikaru no Go introduced a generation of kids to the ancient game. When it was translated into English, kids in the Bay Area have appeared in local tournaments in larger numbers. Just as San Francisco has a special role in the development of manga, it also has a special role of bringing the game to the West, and that's a story for another day. Gary says, I'm a student at Cal, and it seems to me that a lot of people who are interested in computers and the Internet are also likely to be anime manga fans. Do you have any ideas why these two areas of interest might overlap so much? And Carl Horn, what about that? And what about the role of, is it pronounced, by the way, anime, A-N-I-M-E?
Anime is right, yeah. Well, of course, you know, the great advantage that the Internet, you know, and computers have given is ease of communication. Naturally, almost all anime and manga is produced for a Japanese audience, first of all. And, you know, it's not originally marketed to Americans.
Excuse me, you should mention that anime is the cinematic version, yeah?
It's the animated version, and about half of all anime is a direct adaptation of a manga. So what the Internet did was it really made for much greater ease of communication for people to get information about this material, which in many cases there was very little information on in English. Again, of course, you know, it's untranslated and produced for a different audience. So the Internet has really helped people who are into this field not only find out more about the material itself, but also to hook up and meet, and it's been influential, you know, in the growth of conventions in this country. Every weekend in somewhere in North America, there's a get-together, you know, a convention, which is purely for the enjoyment of anime and manga.
Carl Horn again is manga editor for Dark Horse Comics, and Lucas, join us.
Hi, yeah, I was just calling to talk about some of the earlier anime that was shown here in America to the kids, like Robotech and Thundercats.
Exactly.
And there was also, so I want to mention about the Internet. You guys were, a lot of anime is actually about the Internet, like Ghost in the Shell and anime like that.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Ghost in the Shell, this is based, again, on a manga published by Masamune Shiro and also released in America through Dark Horse. The, you know, this is in some ways, you know, cutting-edge science fiction, the idea of, you know, what are the implications of networking for human consciousness, you know, that eventually the computer stops being just something you use as a tool and it begins becoming an extension of the way you think, you know, and the way you look at the world. The as for earlier generations of anime, of course, Fred Schott was going back to the 1960s, you know, with Astro Boy. I'm personally of the 1980s generation, so I'm very familiar with, you know, works like Robotech. Robotech was a somewhat subversive work for its time because while it was ostensibly seen to be about, you know, cool weapons and, you know, F-14s transformed into giant robots, it actually was constantly questioning the basis of war and was sort of presenting to kids that most wars were fought for political reasons. And that was rather intense stuff, you know, during the Reagan era.
That was didactic and politicizing, wasn't it, pretty much?
Exactly. It was kind of like it looked like Top Gun, but in some ways it had kind of the opposite message.
Well, I was looking at one of these manga books, Who Fighter, Weird War, and it's three stories, but one of them is Heart of Darkness, and it not only, of course, brings up Conrad, it brings up Coppola and Apocalypse Now.
Exactly. You know, land war in Asia has a, you know, very special meaning, you know, for the Japanese. You know, before the U.S., you know, fought a war in Vietnam, the French fought a war there. And before the French fought a war there, the Japanese fought a war there. So, you know, the links of history, you know, are very strong there. And the Pacific War still haunts the Japanese, you know, very strongly.
Yeah, are we going to see anything about the Rape of Nanking in any of these manga comics, though?
I was surprised recently. There's a manga I'm working on called, it's a horror manga called The Kurosagi Corpse Delivery Service. It's about Buddhist college students who have the ability to talk with the dead. And I was very surprised to see come up as a story element, the infamous units, I want to say Unit 714, but I've got the number wrong. It was the biological warfare unit of the Japanese Army in Manchuria. And at their research station in Harbin, they conducted horrific experiments on thousands of people and tested biological weapons, you know, sometimes called the, you know, the Japanese Dr. Mengele. Yeah. I'd never seen this come up before in a manga.
Carl Horn, again with us from Portland, Oregon, is manga editor for Dark Horse Comics. And if you'd like to join us, you can. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. Like to hear from some manga readers or enthusiasts. If you have a question or comment, again, our number, 866-733-6786. Or you can join us by email. And the email address here is forum@kqed.org. Miles, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to first say that I'm much enjoying the topic this morning, but I wanted to describe my own experience as an introduction to anime and manga and then get your guest's reaction to that. I grew up watching Voltron, Transformers, but I didn't really recognize these as products of Japan or having Japanese influences. What really opened my eyes, sort of opened the door for me, was the growing popularity in the mid to late 80s of Japanese video games, particularly the sort of role-playing games, Squaresoft's Final Fantasy series, still continuing, being one of them, for introducing me to the Japanese style of storytelling, the Japanese character stereotypes and archetypes, and that is what really got me looking back again at a manga and anime. And I think this also has some applicability to one of your earlier emails, wondering about why there seems to be this tie between people interested in technology and those with interest in Japanese culture. And I wonder whether the popularity of Japanese video games and that sort of backdoor into American culture has something major to do with it.
Fred Schott.
Oh, I think that for a lot of young people, that video games, and especially RPG games and so forth, have had a huge influence. I think still that in Japan you can make the argument that manga are at the core of this larger sort of Japanese information entertainment empire, which includes anime and also video games. But I think one thing that's really important to keep in mind for Americans is that what we are viewing here and what we are enjoying here in the United States is not necessarily what Japanese people are enjoying at the same time. There's a big time lag between works that become popular in Japan and the United States, although it's shrinking. And also there's a very big filter, so that a lot of American fans tend to think that Japanese manga are heavily weighted towards stories about technology and the internet, and also about the atomic bomb and so forth and so on. And unfortunately, what is hard to see here is that actually manga in Japan, and to a certain extent anime, are much more broad in terms of content than what we're exposed to here. Publishers in the United States generally are forced to concentrate on works that they think there's a market for. So automatically you have, until recently, you have manga works that tended to be targeted, when they were translated, they were works that were targeted mainly at an American young male audience, which was more interested in internet and technology and also some of these themes such as science fiction. It's very arguable as to whether shows, TV shows such as Transformers and even Robotech are really Japanese animation.
Let me thank Miles for his call and go right to San Leandro. Florence, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, my question was, I wondered why in the display that I saw in San Francisco Asian Museum, all of the humans depicted in the mangas all have big, round, Betty Boop eyes.
That's the Disney effect in some way, or influence, isn't it, Fred?
Yeah, there's several factors involved there, and I should say, since the caller brought it up, the exhibit at the museum is definitely worth seeing to get an idea of how manga and anime culture have evolved. Tezuka he made his professional debut in 1947, and he was a huge fan not only of Walt Disney, but also Max Fleischer and a variety of American comic strip artists. And also he was very exposed to American comic books. But because of his love of animation in particular, and especially of Walt Disney and Max Fleischer, he tended to incorporate some of the visual elements that he liked. And one of those was the use of large eyes. Now, the use of large eyes is not just a Japanese phenomenon. If you look at children's culture around the world, you'll find generally that artists tend to draw the eyes of their characters larger because the eyes are the window on the soul. And by making the eyes larger in cartoons and comics, you can express a lot more emotion. There was also a tendency in Japanese fashion illustration, even before the war, to draw young women with rather large eyes, and that was partly an influence from fashion magazines in France and the continent.
What about the influence of higher culture? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the mask and no drama, for example, and connections there.
Well, it's interesting when people point out that Japanese manga characters often have big eyes, and it's true, although the eyes are getting smaller recently, I should say. But if you look at kabuki illustrate, or not kabuki, but the kabuki bromides in the early ukiyo-e, or woodblock prints from the 19th century and earlier, and also if you look at no characters, actually the eyes are very, very small. So in the Japanese popular mind, at least, the ideal for characters for that were used in entertainment changed very much, especially after the post-war period. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But it just goes to show how, I think, how plastic people's perceptions of themselves are. And that's true of Americans, too. If you look at the styles that are used in American comic books, they have changed quite a bit over the years.
And Florence, we thank you for the call. You were going to add, Carl Horn?
The issue of perception, of course, is very important. Someone who's not Japanese may look at these characters and say, but they don't look Japanese to me. But they may not realize that the way they act and the way they express themselves to a Japanese reader, they would have no doubt whatsoever these are Japanese people. And the Japanese, in manga, they would have their own, often quite stereotypical, image of what a American foreigner is supposed to look like. So when a genuine American shows up, you'll definitely know, you know, when they do.
Let me go to some of the emails here. This is Lazar, who says, how about the famous manga Adolf by Osamu Tezuka about Hitler? Is manga a bit anti-Semitic, or is this just reverse Spiegelman? Fred Schott?
Well, actually, I think if you read the Adolf story, you would not come away with the impression that Tezuka is anti-Semitic at all. It's a much more complicated story than that. But you can find almost any theme in manga, and I think that's the most important point. Manga are used today to depict just about any subject. I'm currently reading a manga about Kim Il-sung, and I'm also reading a manga by another acquaintance of mine who was in jail in Japan, and it's an autobiographical story about what it's like to be in Japanese jails.
Here's a listener named Kid who says, I'll be moving to Tokyo in August with a 13-year-old Naruto fan. Is there any series in Japanese that might be good for him to start off with? He'll be learning Japanese, and I can speak and read myself, so I can help. Fred Schott?
Well, I think Carl can probably point out some specific works. One thing I would suggest is to read something that has a theme that's something that's familiar. So if you read a manga that's set in the United States or read a manga that's set that has a theme about something that you like, that's something you're familiar with, it would be much easier to read, whether it's a Japanese or English.
Carl, you want to comment?
That's excellent advice. And yeah. If you're starting off, you know, learning Japanese, then obviously the best manga magazines to read would be the ones directed towards the younger readers. One for the youngest readers, for example, is Korokoro, which is home of the famous Doraemon comic. And that particular... You know, we talked about the Japanese language before. An interesting issue with Japanese language is the Japanese themselves often have difficulty understanding it. That is to say, the kanji, you know, the ideograms. Often, especially for younger readers, they come equipped with little pronunciation guides that remind you of how to pronounce it. When the Japanese give a business card, they're often bilingual, English on one side, you know, Japanese on the other. But that's often for the benefit of the Japanese to help remind you how to pronounce their name. So don't be don't be discouraged about learning Japanese. It takes a lot of work, but it's definitely worth the effort, as you know, as Fred Schott can attest.
Well, maybe you can help me with this pronunciation again. Is it Gekkaika?
Gekkigai, I think.
Gekkigai. Yeah. Is that yeah? And what is that exactly? I mean, I keep coming across it.
Well, Gekkigai was a it was a movement I believe started in the 1950s. And Fred, would it be fair to say in some ways it was something of a reaction to Tezuka?
Oh, I would say definitely so, sort of an anti-Tezuka movement. And the emphasis was on realism and action comics, and it targeted a slightly higher age group. So many of the readers in the beginning were high school students and also factory workers. And their whole emphasis was on more realism as opposed to the sort of Disney-esque style that Tezuka had worked with.
Speaking of Disney, here's Karen from San Jose. Says, I recall a cartoon on TV called Kimba, the White Lion, and think there are many similarities to Disney's The Lion King. Are they related somehow, or is there a connection? Do we know?
Fred, I think you're the best person to talk about that.
There are many people in the United States and also in Japan who believe that The Lion King is heavily influenced by Tezuka's Kimba the White Lion, which was Japan's first color TV animated series, which came out around 1965. There was a protest movement in Japan that was organized by artists and editors and people in the industry, and they sent a letter of complaint to the distribution arm of the Walt Disney Company in Japan, but I believe there was never any acknowledgement of the debt that the producers had to the Japanese. This was a rather sore point for people in the industry in Japan.
George, thank you for waiting. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
Oh, on the topic that you were just talking about, I was very interested to add that. I'd like to add that there's this T-shirt going around among anime buffs that has the Kimba the White Lion in front of a mirror saying, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who created me after all?"
Oh, and yeah, has, I've seen that one.
Yeah. But I wanted to talk about how all that's been talked about is mainstream stuff that's in manga for America. But yeah, in Japan, there's basically lots of other topics explored in manga that's really, really, which some people might even consider very prurient. And I like to hear some more about what you think about those types of genres.
Carl Horn?
Well, it's been said that manga pretty much covers every field, and just as there are manga which are completely wholesome, there are manga which are completely unwholesome. It's a fully integrated form of entertainment, you know. Just like anything, you can find anything on home video, you can pretty much find anything in manga. I think people's reactions to that material will be, you know, pretty much, you know, what they're looking for and what they're in the mood for. Obviously, the more extreme material is not generally what people are looking for in the mainstream. That's, you know, why it's considered extreme. People sometimes like to pull it out of the crowd and say, look at this, look at what manga is. You know, it's so depraved, so perverted. And you can always find, you know, examples of that in any form of, you know, entertainment. But, you know, they're just one part of it, and it's a very, you know, inaccurate sort of picture.
Here's another listener who has something about Kimba. Michael says, I grew up watching Kimba in the 60s by Tezuka. I had the chance to review some episodes on DVD a few years ago. I was struck at how Kimba, a lion and emperor of the jungle, tried to find peaceful means to resolve conflict. He always tried to use negotiation and cooperation and only use force as a last resort. This is very different from contemporary anime, where battling, dueling, and violence are the whole point of the show. Want to comment, Fred Schott?
Yeah, I think one of the stock themes of Tezuka, actually, in many of his works, is a belief that differences between people can be resolved through negotiation. And if you look at, actually, Astro Boy is a robot who is essentially an intermediary between the world of humans and the world of machines, because the story is set, actually, in our world, where Tezuka had envisioned, although he created the story in 1951, he had envisioned that by 2003 we would be living in a world with highly advanced robots. Similarly, in the work that you know as The Jungle Emperor or Kimba the White Lion, the main character is an intermediary between the world of humans and the world of animals in Africa, between mankind and nature. And Tezuka often explored this theme. I just wanted to point out that one thing I think the caller alluded to here is that in the United States, we tend to be exposed much more to these almost apocalyptic anime and manga that have a strong science fiction theme with a lot of machines and destruction. But actually, Japanese readers are enjoying manga that are about mahjong games. They're enjoying a lot of stories that are about daily life at school and also office work. There's a huge genre of manga that deal with nothing but the trials and tribulations of working in an office and all the politics that go along with that. We will never see most of those manga here in the United States simply because our interests and our culture are very different.
Well, it's fascinating how these cultural differences manifest themselves. I mean, they're using you're talking about technology, young people communicating in Japan in ways, you know, through their cell phones digitally and in terms of transcriptions and the like that simply haven't hit the States, and there was thought that it would, but hasn't yet. Here's another listener, Fred, who says, I'm interested to hear your guest comments on the recent historical revisionism by Japanese scholars by linking manga and past Japanese art forms, kabuki, woodblocks. The current exhibit at the Asian Art Museum is a perfect example of this movement. What do they think about the Japanese scholars who believe that this is not actually reconnecting Japanese with past culture, but further Americanizing their culture by forcing a link between their historical artistic cultural tradition and an art from that they inherited from America?
Well, I think that's an interesting point. Actually, at the Asian Museum, there's this wonderful exhibit in tandem with the Tezuka exhibit of prints, woodblock prints by one of my favorite ukiyo-e artists, Tsukioka Yoshitoshi. Tezuka himself probably would have rolled over in his grave at the idea that he would have there would be an exhibit of his work next to that of Yoshitoshi, because they're very different. But I think you can make the argument that even though manga and traditional art in Japan are very different animals, they're very different things, the way that the comic book format has been embraced in Japan has a lot to do with this long tradition of line art that is used to entertain in Japan. And that's line art that involves not only woodblock prints, but also traditional scrolls. There's a very, very long tradition in Japan of art that's line art, it's entertaining, it's often humorous, and sometimes it's bawdy and erotic. It goes back way, way before manga.
Yes,
so there is a link.
I think at this point, the success of what comics have become in Japan, the success, you know, really found nowhere else in the world, it's kind of like saying about Japanese cars, yeah, but Henry Ford was an American. That's true, but today Toyota, you know, makes the best cars and is the most successful auto company.
That's going to have to be the final word. We're out of time here. Boy, what a note to end on. But Carl Horn, want to appreciate the time you spent with us and thank you for it. Again, manga editor for Dark Horse Comics and Fred Schott. His books include Manga Manga, The World of Japanese Comics, and the Astro Boy Essays. And he is also a translator and expert on Tezuka Osamu. Let me thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we do thank you for your listenership. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Elsa Chang, Sharon Adam, and Christina Shaheen. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.